You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
I want to welcome all of you to the Brookings Institution and this morning, and I also want to welcome all of those who have decided to tune in on the webcast. Real glad you can join us today. My name is Amy Liu, and I'm a vice president here at the Brookings Institution and director of the Metropolitan Policy Program. You know, our program here at Brookings and the National League of Cities have the honor of bringing together a distinguished group of leaders who have traveled from very far to join us to discuss a critical issue, the importance of inclusive growth. In the U.S., the U.S.'s economy is expanding, but we know that the gains are not benefiting many members of our society. And you see this challenge not only at the national level in the United States, but locally as well. Recently, we produced a Metro Monitor, and in that report, Brookings looked at the health and performance of our nation's largest city regions in the United States since the recession. We found that nearly all of the largest metro areas have experienced improvements in jobs, in output, mirroring the broader growth in the economy. But of the 100 largest metro areas, only 8 have made progress in inclusion in terms of improving, making progress on employment, on income, in our population, including by race. In short, what those findings tell me is that economic growth is easy, but inclusion is much harder. And that is why we need to be much more intentional about how we extend the benefits of growth and engage more people in our prosperity. And that is the topic we are going to talk about today. Now, despite these challenges, however, cities remain essential to achieving what we at Brookings call an advanced economy that works for all. Cities matter because they are the hubs of innovation, commerce, and critical infrastructure, and they are the places where people from across diverse backgrounds go to seek jobs and opportunity. In an era of political gridlock at the national level, we have found that city leaders have also become the source of optimism and pragmatic problem solving, working across all sectors to position their communities for broad-based prosperity. Now, we're not alone in this belief. We're tremendously excited that in March of this past year, the OECD, in partnership with the Ford Foundation, which is also a generous supporter of this program at Brookings, launched an inclusive growth in cities campaign. Anchored by a network of champion mayors from across the globe, the campaign intends to raise awareness of rising inequality across our cities and developing concrete solutions where the majority of global citizens live today, our urban centers. Now, behind this effort is the energetic, passionate, and dynamic Secretary General of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, Angel Gurria. The Secretary General will discuss in a moment a new economic report and the rationale for an inclusive growth in cities campaign. And no doubt, with the tragic events this week in Orlando, he will also stress why inclusive growth and social cohesion is even more important today. Now, before we start the program, let me just talk a little bit about the logistics and the flow for today. After Secretary General speaks, and he will take a few minutes of questions, so be prepared for things you might want to ask, we will then move to a panel discussion with Q&A that will feature public, private, and civic leaders from cities and metropolitan areas in the United States who are going to share their lessons on what they are doing to tackle this problem and opportunity around inclusive growth. Now, those watching today's event on webcast also have an opportunity to join in our Q&A today. You can tweet your questions through the Twitter using the hashtag #InclusiveCities, and my colleague Allison will be monitoring the Twitter feed throughout the event and look for questions that we can pose. Now, I am pleased to introduce OECD Secretary General Angel Gurria. Now, Secretary Gurria has had an impressive career. Now, during his tenure at OECD, the organization has expanded its membership and strengthened its role as a hub for global dialogue and debate around membership, and strengthened its role around global dialogue and debate around economic policy. Now, previously, Secretary General Gurria served as Mexico's Minister of Foreign Affairs, during which time he played a key role in negotiations for NAFTA. And as some of you may know, Secretary General tends to enjoy sharing his work with global leaders. And we are major consumers of the great research that comes out of the OECD. So it's my turn to return the favor. Given your leadership in NAFTA, I wanted to share with you our report, Metro North America, which shows how important our U.S., Canada, and Mexico metro areas are part of the integrated fabric of production in the world economy. And I wanted to share with you Remaking Economic Development, which is a paper that I authored, which I think of as a playbook for cities on how they can create an economy that can create continuous growth and inclusion for our citizens. So I'm going to hand these to you. And I have to say, I've gotten to know the Secretary General over the last couple visits, and I just am really impressed by his commitment to this issue. So on behalf of Brookings and the National League of Cities, please join me in welcoming Secretary Gurria.
Thank you, Amy, and thank you to Brookings for the invitation and to all of you for joining us this morning. This afternoon, actually a little later, we will be launching the 2016 Economic Survey of the United States. You shouldn't see it because it's under embargo officially, but don't tell anybody. And with it, we are going to be presenting this brochure called Improving Opportunities for Women in the United States. It's a sort of an amuse-bouche that we're adding to the we're very French, you know, so that we're adding to the economic survey of the United States. And I think I should start with this because it's good news, mostly. 7 years after the depths of the financial crisis, the U.S. is making a comeback, registering one of the strongest economic recoveries in the OECD. Our survey charts increased output, reduced unemployment, improved fiscal sustainability. Certain regions and sectors in particular have experienced stronger growth, California and the Northeast Corridor, for example. However, the revival in economic fortunes has not prevailed evenly across the country or across different parts of the population. Just over a year ago, when I was here last, I spoke to you about the state of inequalities in the United States and across the OECD. Now, sadly, despite the U.S.'s steady recovery, the trends in income inequality have continued to worsen even after the crisis. Now, we say even after the crisis. Unfortunately, we are still living the consequences of the crisis. The legacies are very heavy, slow growth and high unemployment and growing inequalities and a very precipitous drop in confidence and trust. Those are still not even scars. They're still open wounds from the crisis. And the question of inequality has continued. Now, let me tell you to what extent. The average income of the top 10% in the case of the United States was 19 times higher than that of the bottom 10%. He says, so what? Well, it's compared to 10 times, 9.6 times actually, in the OECD on average. So you're talking about the U.S. now being about double the average of the OECD. Now, and this is, how is it in terms of evolution? Well, the average 10 times was 7 times only a generation ago. And in the U.S., it's been going from 12 to 15 to now close to 18, 19. So clearly very, very fast and clearly in the wrong direction. Large segments of the population continue to face significant obstacles in the labor market and aren't sharing in the gains of a strengthening U.S. economy. The share of women in the labor force has continued to decline, reaching levels below Germany and Japan. And a considerable wage gap persists, with women earning around 18% less than men, something which is almost now a cliché. Minority groups also earn less and have lower rates of labor market participation. In particular, African Americans and Hispanic men earned slightly less than three-quarters the income of white men, a gap that has hardly budged in over a decade. This is the other problem, that you see the problem and you measured it, you know, 10 years ago, and then you see it, you measure it today, and it doesn't seem to be, you know, it's like Johnny Walker. It just keeps on, you know, so comfortably. We're not making any progress on such sensitive issues. Now, employment rates have also fallen among people with disabilities. The number of people receiving disability benefits now is larger than those receiving unemployment benefits. Now, this has two reasons. One of them is that you've created 16 million jobs in the last 5 years, so you're kind of bringing down the unemployment rate, but also that the disability list is growing so fast. Clearly, the U.S. can and must do better to ensure the gains from the stronger economy are shared by all. Now, a more inclusive economy, a more inclusive labor market are also key to boosting growth and productivity. We now have mounting evidence that rising inequalities harm growth because up to the poorest 40% of the population find it too onerous to invest in their own skills and education. They're paying for their livelihoods, but they can't afford the luxury of investing in their own futures because they're spending all their income, you know, paying for their present. So you have a deterioration of their outlook. Now, fighting inequality is not only a global and national concern, it's also very local. We've been reminded in recent months just how small and connected our troubled world has become. The refugee crisis, climate change, international terrorism, the heavy legacy of the economic crisis on growth and jobs, and rising inequality. And then the, what you call the systemic worldwide issues that connect with local issues. The best example, the tragedy in Orlando. Now, but even as the effects of globalization spread, its impacts are always bound to play out locally. Our work on inequalities has shown that the gap between the rich and the poor is higher, often rising faster in larger cities, including in the wealthiest, primarily due to skills distribution and to the capturing of the top earners. In those cities, rich and poor people often live segregated in different neighborhoods. A forthcoming OECD report called Making Inclusive Growth Happen in Cities suggests that the most income-segregated cities in the Netherlands and France are more or less at comparable levels to the least segregated cities in the United States. Now, we know traditionally that in European societies, the level of equality is higher, the level of inequality is lower. But when you look at the cities, the highest are equivalent to the least segregated here. So it shows, again, that there's a lot of distance to go here in the U.S. Inequality is not just about money, by the way. It is also felt in labor market exclusion, lower social mobility, greater polarization in educational and health outcomes. And here, too, we have reason to be worried about the state of our cities. Today in Brussels, I was going to say we are launching, but actually because of time difference, we have launched our Regions at a Glance publication. This report, this is a yearly publication. The report shows that when income, jobs, and health outcomes are considered together, disparities across cities and regions are consistently starker than those in income only. So you're talking income, jobs, and health together rather than only income. For instance, recent findings in Baltimore suggest that life expectancy can differ by double-digit numbers across neighborhoods in a single city. Forget about, you know, we're not talking about across countries, we're not talking about states in the United States, we're talking about neighborhoods in a single city. Take the case of education, where the OECD review of the Chicago region, we did Chicagoland, not just the legal perimeter of Chicago, but the 21 counties, three states. We report that high school graduation rates range from 57% in the city itself, the inner city, to over 95% in some of the wealthier, better off suburban areas. So you're talking almost double, and just a few miles away. These inequalities not only take an economic toll, they also come at great humanitarian costs. These are lives cut short. These are children stopped in their tracks from fulfilling their full potential. Now, the good news is that good policies can make a big difference. We can make a difference. And no one knows this better than mayors. We have the chief executive here of King County today. We're honored to have you here, sir. By the way, he just became a champion mayor for inclusive growth. Subnational governments control many policy levers for promoting prosperity, well-being, and inclusive growth. They carry around 40% of the total public spending in the OECD and 60% of public spending. So you're talking about the majority of the money that is spent, at least by in the public accounts, is spent at the local level. This is precisely why, just a few months ago in New York, as Amy informed, with Mayor Bill de Blasio and 20 other mayors from around the world, in collaboration with the Ford Foundation, we launched the Inclusive Growth in Cities campaign. And Lamia is signaling, and she'll wring my neck if I don't do this, you know, which is a... No, but these are the proceedings from the launch of the Inclusive Growth in Cities campaign, which actually produced the New York proposal for inclusive growth in cities. We now have about 50 champion mayors from New York to Paris, Minneapolis to Medellin, Atlanta to Cape Town and beyond. And by the way, on the 21st of November, better start packing, we'll have a meeting of all the champion mayors in Paris, hosted by Mayor Anne Hidalgo. Now, champion mayors have signed on to this New York proposal for inclusive growth in cities, setting out a common commitment to a policy agenda that aims to ensure that cities work for all. And this means providing education and training systems. This is a question of enabling people of all ages to develop skills and improve their life chances. Skills are the new currency. You know, when some of us studied business in our young age, the teachers would kind of try to play games with us and say, what's the success of business? And we all try to say things and then say, location, location, location. You know? Now location, of course, doesn't matter. But now they say education, education. Well, now it's skills, 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 which is a combination of education with innovation, with lifelong learning, with vocational training, etc. That is the new currency of productivity, competitiveness, and progress. For instance, for new immigrants, cities can build bridges to employment, support recognition of skills gained overseas, provide training to adapt existing skills to new contexts. Let me just mention one program in New York City which offers free courses to help small business owners launch and expand operations. And they do it in English, Spanish, Russian, and Mandarin. So it's an interesting example. Promoting labor markets that make the most of women, youth, those with disabilities, and foreign-born populations is a very important other pillar. It includes family-friendly policies that make it easier for women to remain in the workforce. The latest U.S. economic survey reports that states that have implemented such policies are recording higher levels of women in the workforce, including in management positions. Investing in high-quality and universally accessible infrastructure and public services, again, another important pillar. This can open up new employment and training opportunities for the most disadvantaged, promoting both growth and equity objectives. And it means changing the way in which we build and in which we move around our cities. Mayors tell us that affordable housing is one of the biggest challenges that they face in the city. And the topic remains at the top of the global urban agenda. But too often, housing policies are divorced from a broader strategy for urban development or transport and access to services. So we need housing policies that aim to build cities rather than building houses. We have very, very bad examples of cases, one of them in my own country, in the urban metropolitan area of Mexico City, but also throughout the country, where they started to build houses and houses and houses and houses because they have this fixed income revenue that they felt they had to spend, so they build a lot of houses. And the houses are disconnected from the cities. There's no transport, there's no communications, there's not even appropriate services because the municipalities don't grow up as fast as the needs. And therefore, what you have is total disconnection. What you have is hundreds of thousands of empty houses in countries which have housing shortages, which is obviously a tragedy. It's an economic tragedy and a human tragedy. Now, I'd like to praise the joint efforts of the Department of Housing and Urban Development here in the U.S., the Department of Transportation, the Environmental Protection Agency, in creating the Partnership for Sustainable Communities. It aims to promote integrated urban planning to help local authorities meet housing, transport, and environmental objectives together. And that is the most important concept. So what next? Over the coming months, we will work with our coalition of champion mayors to elevate their voices, their visions, their ambitions on the global stage. Their efforts and insights must inform national priorities and advance global agendas. We will continue to refine measurement tools, identify policies at work, and help governments in the implementation process. We like to say that it's about implementation, 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 but not necessarily in that order. And remember, we have our work cut out. We now have the Sustainable Development Goals, and now we have the COP21, and now we even have our targets on taxes at the OECD. We got all that cleared and approved in 2015, and now it's about implementation. We'll also develop a platform to enable cities to exchange best practices in the policy domains that matter for inclusive growth. I mentioned that Mayor Anne Hidalgo of Paris will host the second meeting of the champion mayors in Paris, building on the New York proposal. And, of course, we're working already on the Paris action plan so that it focuses again on implementation. Now, we know we can't go at it alone. This campaign aims to bring key stakeholders around the table, Brookings, very, very importantly, and serve as a global platform for the debate on inequalities. We're working hand in hand with our supporting institutions, the National League of Cities, the Cities Alliance, the C40, which is a, we've been working with the C40 for many, many years now. They're the largest 40 cities, ICLE, United Cities and Local Governments, United Way Worldwide, to try to make the aspirations of inclusive cities worldwide a reality. We're delighted that the mayors of Atlanta, Birmingham, Los Angeles, Portland, New York, Santa Fe, Santa Monica, and King County are among the first U.S. cities to have joined the campaign, and we hope many others will follow. So, dear friends, the OECD's mission is to promote better policies for better lives. This is how we define our aspiration and our mission and our vision. If we want economies and societies in which everyone has a shot of success, we must ensure that cities are at the heart of that fight. Thank you. Yeah. Couple of questions. I'm told questions or comments or violent objections.
Yes, thank you. You mentioned the gap between the top 10% and bottom 10%, but the inequalities between the top 1% and the 10%, or between the 0.1% and the top 1%, those at the top, those inequalities are much greater, and these are people that basically have the same set of skills. So there's something in addition to skills that accounts for the surging inequality of the last 30 years, and I was wondering if you could address that at all.
Finance. Finance. It's the, what you're talking about, the 1%, then what you're talking about, 0.1%. I mean, the financial sector grew a lot. People were attracted to the financial sector. The best and the brightest would come out of our universities and be recruited by, very aggressively, by the way, by the, normally it was consulting firms, lawyers, and banks. The banks took a very important place. The remuneration patterns are somewhat different. What makes it different is that, say, in the industrial world, the manufacturing world, the commercial world, the chief executives can make a lot of money because of their options and whatever you want, stock options. But the number of people in the financial sector that can make a lot of money, and because of the huge amounts involved, this is universal banks, you know, that work all over the world, et cetera, has been traditionally very large. And if anything, it has accelerated given the specialization and given... So I think that explains a lot of this polarization. The second is that look at what has happened to interest rates. If you have savings, your interest rates will tend to have your savings, you know, produce less in the relatively in the least risky types of investments, whereas the people who are running these large corporations or who are running the financial world, etc., tend to have be better informed, make better personal investment decisions. So that's another question. It's about information, but also it's about, let's say, the shrewdness of the individuals. And last but not least, it has to do with the tax system. The tax system in our societies, in many cases, is not progressive enough. It's capped in many cases. The top rates are capped. In fact, let me just tell you to finish that you used to have, and this was, we used to do this for Latin America because, let's say that everybody was at 50% Gini, 50 point Gini. Everybody was just as unequal in the beginning. But then you applied the taxes and you applied the social security contributions and you got, what you got back for that. And basically, the reduction of the, in Europe, let's say, reduced by 40%. In the United States, it used to be at least a third. And in Latin America, it didn't move an inch. Because people don't pay taxes. Hmm? That's a good reason. Hmm? But also because there's a kind of a very large informal labor market. So you when you look at the contributions to the Social Security, et cetera, they don't make that much of a difference. But what has happened? In the United States, we're losing this. Less and less the tax system is a great equalizer. That's important, and we should review. There are many reasons why you should review the tax system in the United States. But this is one of them. It's kind of losing its teeth in terms of as an equalizer. So sorry for the very long answer. And the reason why we say 10% is because the 1% has these explanations. It's almost a cliche now, but also because it does not, does not give us any large numbers in terms of the implications. Yes, it gives us very brutal differences, but the problem is not with, is not in the 1% up or down. It's basically in much larger numbers. As I said, up to 40% of the workforce may be threatened by technology or by the lack of skills. So we're talking very massive numbers. And that's why we say the 10% as a measure. And also because it helps us to compare better. Because the phenomenon of the 1% is also quite peculiar to the U.S. It's less, it's also peculiar to countries where they have big financial centers, like the U.K. and others, but it's more peculiar to the U.S. whether the 10% is more useful to compare more of the societies. Yeah, sorry. One more? Yes, ma'am. Don't believe anything they say. No. Yes. I am going to address this when we present the Economic Survey of the United States today, but let me give you a bit of an advance here. It's been 8 years into the crisis, and in these 8 years, we've been striving to consolidate the fiscal accounts, to bring down the deficits, which the United States has done very well, by the way. And the United States did it right because they did the heavy lifting first. They kind of front-loaded the fiscal effort. So they were slashing 1.5% per year. Instead, now they're working at about 0.5% per year, which is fine. It's very sustainable without sacrificing growth. And it's a bad international scenario, so it's appropriate that the U.S. doesn't have to be putting the brakes on for fiscal reasons. But you're absolutely right. What were the things that were wrong, and why did we have to go for fiscal consolidation and also for a great refurbishing of the banking sector, capital, regulations, supervision, etc., a number of laws, and sometimes even over-regulation, because, you know, you had a very lax, what was perceived to be a very lax regulation, and then it became kind of pendular. And now we're a little worried that the banks are not lending enough, sometimes at least partially because of the regulation. But so we are in a much better position today. We're more stable, more solid. We are less vulnerable. And what we're saying is, let's imagine that everybody, when I mean everybody, I mean like the G20, for example. Let's take the G7, okay? Whatever the baseline is, add 0.5% of GDP only for infrastructure projects that are of high multiplier effect, meaning you spend one, you get two, you know, in exchange. And that paradoxically, because they would break bottlenecks and make the economy more productive, more efficient, would, after 2 years or so, bring down the debt to GDP, because the GDP would grow. One of the greatest tragedies, where we're only talking about measuring GDP, debt to GDP, is that the GDPs have been shrinking. So even if the debt stays the same, the ratios continue to rise. In Japan, for example, you have 230% debt to GDP. And in Greece, you're almost 170 to 180%. Because in Italy, even if the debt doesn't rise, the denominator, which is the GDP, have shrunk. Now, for the first time, they stabilize. But the question is, how can you make the GDP grow? Well, you can do it in a controlled environment. We're not talking about going, you know, ballistic. We didn't turn from being, you know, totally austerity biased towards being Keynesian from one day to the next. It's that today we can do it in a controlled way, and you can plot the path. You say, okay, you deviate somewhat, but you apply it to these infrastructure projects or to creating the human resources, to the skills, etc., and then that will itself accelerate growth, and that will then itself bring down the debt to GDP, and you will have growth and jobs in the meantime. Among other things, why? Because what we have today is not working. It's mediocre, it's undesirable, it's flat. And the problem is, it looks like it's going to stay like that if we don't have a departure. So who can do it? Basically, what we're saying is everybody can if you do this, because if 0.5% is going to give you X growth, 0.5% by everybody is going to give you X growth, my plus maybe 0.25%, a quarter percentage growth more. So again, there's a mutually reinforcing underlying strength here. And last but not least, because there's a beggar thy neighbor issue. Now, problem is you're very far away from having a you're very far away from having a consensus. You have people like Canada, which are practicing exactly what I'm telling you now. In their last budget, they said, okay, we'll take, you know, 2 years longer to get to the balance, etc. But they only have 30% debt to GDP. The average of the OECD is 100. Now, but what did the Germans do? Well, when they said they're going to spend 10 billion in the refugees, I said, oh my God, yes, you know. Now they're going to be spending more, and there's going to be a kind of some balancing here during Europe. You know, the Germans are going to be spending more. They're going to be buying things from the other guys. Lo and behold, they present their budget, and it's a balanced budget, including the 10 billion. Huh? You can never trust these guys. You know, they're They're so virtuous. No, they have a constitutional constraint and a fiscal, you know, a fiscal authority, et cetera, so they're bound by it. But what I'm saying is there is this, not everybody's convinced that this is the way out, but what we believe, and now the IMF has joined us, and as I said, Canada is going to be a very interesting real case laboratory about this theory, precisely for the reasons that you have mentioned. We think it's high time, after 8 years of tightening our belt, to try a different kind of mix in a controlled environment. As I said, we're not going ballistic. We're just trying a better, what we believe is a better mix. Thank you all.
Great. Thank you so much, Secretary General. And I think he just reinforced why we need both sensible macro policy, but also very strong, innovative strategies at the local level. And that is what we're going to turn to next. So I'm going to ask Lamia and the panelists to come up to the stage. And while they are getting situated, I just wanted to say a few words about the folks who are on this panel. First of all, this conversation is going to be chaired by Lamia Kamal, who is the Senior Advisor to Secretary General Gurria and the coordinator of the Inclusive Growth in Cities campaign. She's going to be joined by three cities. And what I just learned today, thanks to the decision by Chief Executive Constantine, is each one of these cities, Seattle, King County, Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Atlanta, are part of the early champion cities that have committed to this campaign. And in addition, each one of these cities are cities that have been longtime friends, collaborators, and partners to the Brookings Institution Metropolitan Policy Program, and we have been real admirers of their creative leadership. And last but not least, I just want to say a few words about Peter Scheer. Peter Scheer is the head of corporate responsibility and the head of DC Metro Region for the JP Morgan Chase. He is a trustee of the Brookings Institution, and they are a longtime supporter of our program. But Peter and his team at JP Morgan Chase have demonstrated their commitment to cities, and we are really grateful for our collaboration with them on global cities. Without further ado, I'm going to hand this over to Lamia. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Annie. Before I introduce our distinguished panelists, let me just add a few words about the campaign, the Inclusive Growth in Cities campaign that we launched with the Ford Foundation. As the Secretary General highlighted in his opening remark, the objective of the campaign is, of course, to elevate the voice of the mayors, and we're glad, Mr. Constantine, that you joined the coalition, to elevate the voice in the global policy debate on inequalities, because so far they were, of course, very vocal, but they were not involved in this debate at the global level. So it's really the very first initiative that is going to target this objective. And, of course, the objective is also to develop a common policy agenda. At the launch of the campaign in New York in last March, all the mayors, they signed on something that we call the New York Proposal. Here you have this proceedings publication, which is displayed there, but it's available online, and you have the New York Proposal. Actually, it identifies several policy areas that we'll consider are crucial to promote inclusive growth in cities. First, education and skills. Second, labor markets. Third, housing and transport. And fourth, infrastructure and public services. So today, in our discussion, we will address some of this issue, and I'm very pleased to see that we have different representatives from different sectors, private, research, philanthropic, and public sectors, because, of course, it's if we want to address inequalities in cities, it's not just a question of political leadership of mayors, which is essential, but we need to engage all type of stakeholders. So first, I'm very pleased to introduce you to Doe Constantine, who is the executive of King County in Washington State. Now he's in his second term. Doe is focused on fighting inequalities and combating climate change. These two issues actually are the heart of the OECD work, in general, and within the context of the campaign, we will have a close look at the nexus between climate and inclusiveness, because, of course, we know that there are strong synergies, but there might be also some trade-off. For instance, when you develop an eco-neighborhood, we know that it can lead to gentrification, so it's not obvious. Next, we have Peter Scheer, who is the head of corporate responsibility and head of the Washington, D.C. region at J.P. Morgan Chase & Co. Peter has led a number of initiatives to close the skills gaps and to make cities more competitive, including the Global Cities Initiative with the Brookings Institute, which aims to boost U.S. metro region's engagement in global markets. We are pleased to have Rodney Simpson, who is the chairman of the Opportunity Hub and chief of Diversity and Inclusion Initiative at Tech Square Labs in Atlanta, which is a network of technical startup founders, educational institution, industry experts, and enterprises working together to develop big companies. The mayor of Atlanta, actually, Kasim Reed, was one of our founding champion mayor. Rodney has been leading work on inclusive innovation, bringing disadvantaged groups into coding, innovation, entrepreneurship, and investment and opportunities. And of course, last but not least, we have Cecil Bedor, the executive vice president of Greater MSP, the Regional Economic Development Partnership of Minneapolis-St. Paul. She has extensive experience in housing, redevelopment, and urban planning, which are among the key levers that we have identified to promote inclusive growth in cities. We are also very glad that she represents the city of Minneapolis, because Mayor Betsy Hodge is another founding champion mayor, and she has been actually very, very active in this area. So briefly, let me explain the format of this panel. We will have three rounds of questions. We will begin with one which will be quite generic. After these three rounds of questions, we will open the floor to Q&A to Q&A, and I think we will have also questions from the tweeters. Our time limit is very tight. Each panelist will have 2 minutes each to respond to each question. So I'm going to start our first round of questions, which will help to set the scene, why inclusive growth matters in cities. So the first question is to Dou Constantin. King County has made significant progress toward inclusive growth in recent years, from transit expansions to low-income communities to early childhood education to paid leave. We'll get into the specifics of the policy soon, but can you start by explaining to the audience, in general term, why you view inclusion of all your residents as a critical precursor to sustain economic growth?
Sure. Thank you. And thank you for inviting me to be here today. And thank you for inviting me to sign on to the Inclusive Cities campaign. Mr. Secretary General, I did not realize that a Paris trip was part of the deal when I signed on, but I'm not disappointed. King County is a jurisdiction of 2.1 million people. City of Seattle is our county seat, but there are many cities that really make up the metropolitan area. And, of course, Brookings has been great about helping frame up the discussion of the role of metropolitan regions in creating national and global change, and that is precisely what we are talking about here today. We have a really dynamic and technology-driven economy, a rapidly growing economy in our region. You may have heard of some of our companies, Amazon, Microsoft, Boeing was born and still lives in our region. And each of these companies is creating enormous opportunity, but we also have widening disparities in our region. Since 2000, 96% of the new households created have household incomes of less than $35,000 or more than $125,000, very little in the middle being created any longer. Why is that a problem? It breaks the deal we have with one another that in America, if you work hard, you'll be able to succeed. It is bad for our economy. We have a consumer-based economy, and that by definition requires consumers. And when people do not have money to spend, our economy suffers as well. We need people who are able to make things. And the things we are making require a higher and higher level of educational attainment and training. And finally, you know, we have the challenge of social cohesion as incomes pull farther apart. Fundamentally, We need inclusive growth because that ladder of success, the opportunity for everyone to succeed, requires that the city itself be a place where they can live, where they can access all that opportunity that's being created, and the predicates to participating in that opportunity, like education and training. I'm looking forward to talking about a couple of the ways in which we're addressing that challenge in our region.
Thank you very much. So you mentioned something very important: inequalities is bad for the economy. I would like to acknowledge the presence of my colleague Monica Kisser, who is heading the work on inequalities at the UCG, and her directorate. They produce clear evidence that they have even calculated the cost for the economy of growing inequalities. So if you have any question, Monica is here to respond to this specific question. I would like now to turn to Peter Cheer. Similar question to you, Peter. JP Morgan has taken a significant role in several initiatives recently promoting inclusive growth, from workforce development to community building to financial literacy. Why has one of the world's largest financial institutions taken such an active role in this space?
I don't know, just a little cynicism in that. Why would a bank be doing this? You know, the Secretary General, this is a big problem. And this is not just a theoretical problem. This is not something just interesting to get together in Washington to talk about. But, you know, if the Secretary General talked about what business teachers taught us years ago about location, you know, for those of us who didn't sleep through all of our philosophy classes, you know, Aristotle said, if you don't have a stable middle class, you can't have a stable political system. You can't have a stable democracy. And we have a very unstable middle class right now. You've got people who are feeling left out, feeling the system is not working for them, and you only have to look at the dysfunction in Washington. You look at, and it's not, this is not just a U.S. thing. I mean, look at what's going on in the U.K. right now. You know, European unity has been the key to peace and stability in a continent that had two world wars, and you're now looking at the trends that they could basically, the UK could get out of it. It's not a theoretical thing. There are too many people who feel the system is not working for them. And as a result, our politics has become so polarized, and we can't do the things we need to do. We're not investing in education. We've got, you know, half of our kids in inner city schools aren't graduating. We're not investing in infrastructure. Anyone try to take the red line this morning down here? Okay. We're not reforming the tax code, as the Secretary General talked about. We're not dealing with international trade and how do we make sure that more people are brought into the global economy. And so you say, why does a large financial institution get involved? How could we not? I mean, the fact is, I would say from two perspectives. One, we have the view that if we have the resources and we have the expertise and we have the data and ability to make a difference, we have a responsibility to do that. But I would also say I think the business community has to recognize this is in our self-interest. It is not good for business to have people not working. It is not good for business to have communities and cities that can't compete in the global economy. And the flip side of that is if we're getting more people into the workforce and higher skilled jobs, if companies can expand, if cities can grow, that's a good thing for all of us. And I think that the business community has to recognize that this is in our self-interest to be able to be part of the solution to these challenges. So that's why we're doing this.
Thank you, Peter. Rodney Sampson. Rodney, you have discussed the concept of inclusive innovation as being the core to your work in Atlanta with Tech Square, the French pronunciation, and Opportunity Hub. It's a topic that is very close to the UCD work. We have just produced a report called The Productivity Inclusiveness Nexus, where we look at how innovation can help combat inequalities, both on the side of consumers, of course, by giving low-income groups access to cheaper and improved goods and services, but also on the side of entrepreneurship by helping people to unlock their productive potential. For you, in concrete terms, what does inclusive innovation mean, and what can be done to help expand the fruit of entrepreneurship to a broader segment of the society, and in particular in Atlanta?
Sure. This will probably be the only time I read something, but I want to be really intentional about this response. For me, this is experiential. Inclusive innovation is a multifaceted construct that exists at the intersection of unrealized opportunity for all. And if fully and openly embraced in every construct of society, it ultimately benefits the greater good of the planet, realized or unrealized. So what does this require, actually? And this is sort of a part of our work. It requires a consciousness of awareness. Minorities and women and immigrants suffer from intentional or non-intentional invisibility that is often met with tokenism. We've got to hack and disrupt this mindset. And it's going to require authentic inclusion. And just to be transparent, those who know our work, this inclusion must be adopted mostly by white males as allies in this work. We have a hashtag we use at Tech Square Labs that says, all ideas matter. And then the third thing is realizing this untapped opportunity, whether it be increased return on investment or access to new customer bases. So how do we kind of bring that thesis to life? In Atlanta, we have been, over the last 4 years, very intentional about being outspoken about diversity and inclusion, but also ensuring that at every phase of the innovation, entrepreneurship, and investment ecosystem, there is representation. There's qualified technical representation. And so when you break down how these ecosystems are built from the idea to the exit, there's normally lot representation. When you look at those who are writing the checks and making the investments, their committees or their investment committees are not representative of the targets that they say that they want to actually invest in or help. So we've been intentional about curating those types of investments and spaces. You know, today we have 25,000 square feet of space near Georgia Tech, and it's probably, in our estimation, the most diverse and inclusive technology incubator on the planet. On one side of the space, you've got black, white, male, female, straight, gay, software engineers programming in Java, JavaScript, Ruby, Python, building and disruptive. And on the other side, you've got 15 to 20 disconnected youth who've been written off that are learning Java. You know, this is not just cute little stuff that, you know, ends up in corporate social responsibility reports. This is stuff where we're actually creating jobs and we're solving real problems. And so when you get early wins and successes, and, you know, money invested, jobs created, and then you start scaling that, you know, at a certain point, you start to develop a model. And from there, when you look at truly diversifying the innovation, entrepreneurship, and investment economy, you start to send the message that, you know, this is an investment thesis. Diversifying your innovation work, your entrepreneurship work, and your investment work is not altruism, but is actually an investment thesis if return on investment or jobs created is your goal.
We will come back to you in the second round of questions, but I would be very interested to learn from you whether you have been able to measure and monitor this this inclusion component of your program. I would like now to turn to Cécile. Cécile, you represent a regional organization, the Greater MSP, Minneapolis-St. Paul, which is, again, a regional economic development partnership. And you have taken a cross-sectoral approach to advance inclusive growth by reaching out to public, private, and NGO sectors. The Secretary General this morning, he mentioned the case of the metropolitan region of Chicago that the OECD has studied some time ago. We have produced 20 or 25 metropolitan region and studies, but every time we are working with organizations like yours because it's very important to have this functional RM regional approach to the issue. Indeed, there are so many aspects to tackle this problem and so many organizations operating in the territory. So how did your organization begin?
Well, that's really hard in 2 minutes, but I used to work for Mayor Coleman prior to coming to Greater MSP, and during that time, we actually started working with the Brookings Institution on the regional approach to economic development. And we really realized that the only people who view the world through political boundaries are elected officials, but everybody else views the world regionally. So, for example, Minneapolis's greatest asset was St. Paul and vice versa. So there are a lot of assets in the region. And as you said, we had a lot of different organizations doing a lot of different things, talking to each other sometimes, and other times just parallel tracks around different economic development approaches. So our region came together and realized that we had a lot of assets to sell, and we really needed to take an asset-based approach to economic development. And in order to do that, we needed to do that together. So as we did our research, we found out that we were one of the few regions of our size that did not have a regional economic development organization that really was that one-stop shop for our businesses that were currently located in our region and for companies that were considering a move that hopefully we would get on the map. So in 2011, we launched, and it's been kind of an interesting road. It's been a real iterative process, I would say. We're a 16-county region, so we're rural, we're ex-urban, we're suburban, and we're very, very urban. We also are kind of unique in that we have two of everything. We have two cities, two counties, two chambers, St. Paul Port Authority, and us. We have about 3.4 million people in our region, and we're about the 48th largest economy in the world. So we have a lot to sell. So we got together, started our organization in 2011 with two people to do three major things. One is to tell our story, sell the region to site selectors and real estate decision makers across the country and across the globe. To take a look at our sectors of strength, and we have significant sectors of strength from med device, health and life sciences to headquarters, et cetera, and to move those from great to greater, really, and then to really take a look at our strategy work. So what are the strategic issues that are really holding back growth in our region? So when we launched, we did the kind of easy stuff, which is marketing and branding. You know, there's traditional ways of doing that, and that continues to evolve, but we all kind of know how to do that. We did the traditional BI work, business investment, of going out to recruit companies to move here. And then really we're quite intentional about visiting the businesses that we currently have to make sure we kept them, and if they were contemplating growth, that we retained that growth. I think the tricky part of it was our third bucket of work, which is the regional strategy. How do we identify what those strategic issues are, and how do we make sure that we're including the right people at the table? So in 2013, 2 years in, we were having a lot of conversations in our board, which is primarily made up of our local CEOs, a lot of Fortune 500s, president of the University of Minnesota, the president of the McKnight Foundation, and others, put together a task force to determine, to do more research on what our strategy should be. And we interviewed dozens and dozens of people to come up with what ended up being one piece of paper. So it wasn't a big plan. It's really literally a piece of paper that's got three buckets of work on it. One is to tell our story. The other one is to focus on talent. Focusing on talent in that we had heard anecdotally that we were having an issue with our talent pipeline. We needed to address that. And the other thing is to really do a very intentional on our sector approach. So that sounds really easy, but that process was really messy, because you ask a lot of questions as you dive into implementation of any kind of strategy of what people are doing and what's working and what's not working and what you can bring to scale and what you can't. And when you're asking people what's working and it may not be working, people are threatened. And if you're thinking about the resources that you have that aren't necessarily growing, but you need to figure out how to deploy them differently, all that is really scary. So I say that to say this is not easy work. It is not simple work. And I think the things that you've just described here are the same thing. There's a lot of players involved. And I think it requires us to be really intentional about who's out there over and above the usual suspects that we come in, that we normally engage. I think the other thing, too, that we've done, probably by default more than anything else, is we have thought about this. We haven't actually coined it as inclusive growth, but it's really been our approach. Equity has been a word that has been tossed around a lot lately. We lose people in our region when we use the word equity because it kind of denotes a fixed pie that gets redistributed. Where our vision is around growth and inclusive growth, that everybody can get behind that because everybody wants growth. And so growth and jobs, growth and capital investment, and growth and opportunities for everybody. So I think my 2 minutes are up, but I think that generally gives you an idea of where we've come from and where we're going. But I would say the process is going to continue to evolve as more players come into the partnership and we advance our work.
Thank you very much, Cecile. We're going to now start the second round of questions, which will address specifically the question of education and training, which are the most critical policy levers to promote inclusive growth. The first question to Doug Constantin. The King County has been growing very fastly and strongly in your country, but the gain from economic expansion has flowed disproportionately to the top, With this in mind, you push through one of the most comprehensive early childhood development program in the country. Let me just give you a figure. Across the OECD, the U.S. has the lowest share of 3 to 5 years old in early education programs. Tell us what your program entails, how you're funding it, and how you convince the voters of King County to support your idea.
So I view my job, first and foremost, as leading us toward that place where every person will have the opportunity to fulfill his or her potential. And there are a number of barriers that keep that from happening, and particularly in a place with enormously expanding opportunity in certain sectors, to have large parts of our population who are so far from being able to access that opportunity is an inexcusable failure by our political class as well as the community more broadly. So I visited the University of Washington's Institute for Learning and Brain Sciences. They're studying the development of the brains of very young children. And what I was able to see there in three dimensions is the effect of environmental factors in the brain development of children. And I realized that one of the things that we're failing to do is to make modest investments early to help ensure that every child gets the enrichment, gets the support that they need early on for that healthy brain development to happen, so that when they arrive at school, they are, in fact, better equipped to succeed and to be able to continue to succeed through life. So we set out to establish Best Starts for Kids. It is a $65 million per year annual investment by the voters of the county. 50% of that will go to enrichment for children under the age of five, really from prenatal through age five. And a lot of that, you think of home visitations, for example, but also screening for emergent challenges with kids. Then follow them through the school years and into early adulthood to continue to monitor for challenges and to help them overcome those challenges. We also invest in communities because investing in the kid is not very successful if the community is not able to support that family and child. And ultimately, I did this because we have been reactive. We run the justice system, and all of our money is going to paying for bad outcomes in kids' lives. And what we needed to do was carve out a little space to begin to invest in that infrastructure, that human infrastructure, that ultimately will allow these kids and their families to be able to get across that gulf and to access the kind of opportunity that's being created in our community. We got broad support across the county, including from the cities outside the city of Seattle, and the voters strongly embraced paying an additional property tax in order that they might be able to make this investment in our collective future. They understood intuitively that we were falling down on that and that we needed to do better.
Thank you very much. Next question to Peter. JP Morgan Chase has made a large bet on workforce development through the New Skills at Work initiative. You have mapped occupations that provide good wages and opportunity for advancement, and then found a new training partnership that would connect the dots between what training institutions provide and what employers and workers need to succeed. This work is happening across a dozen of cities. What are some early successes that you can share from New Skills at Work with us, and what are some of the challenges that remain?
Yeah, so let me just say that the reason we're focused on this, because I think the Secretary General said this, the county executive just said this. I think when we're talking about the disparity that exists, and this is clearly not just the U.S., it's all over the world, there's no one single answer, but I think, you have to look at what our education and training systems doing and the difference that will make in creating opportunity versus no opportunity is just enormous. And so we made a decision. We kind of stepped back about 4 years ago, and we have one of the largest corporate foundations in the United States, and frankly, we weren't spending the money very well, to decide where could we have genuine impact? What are issues that are relevant in cities across the world? And what we heard from mayors and governors literally across the world, from Asia, Latin America, all over the U.S., is the skills gap is a big problem. And we identified three things. One, cities by and large have not had the right data about what are the jobs that are actually being created in a given city. What are the industries that are going to be growing? You know, because it's going to be different. I mean, there'll be some commonalities. You know, healthcare is growing in most every city, technology. But what, you know, in some places it's aeronautics. Other places it could be the, you know, food industry. So really getting the data to understand. And we've actually been working in about 130 cities across the globe right now, including now with the OECD in three or four European cities in South Africa to really map what are the skills, what are the jobs that are being created, and what are the skills that are needed, excuse me, to attain those jobs. So, and that I think has been very successful. And the reason it's been successful is because one of the challenges and opportunities we realize is people who should be talking to each other are not talking to each other. And this is a problem everywhere. The people doing the training and the people doing the hiring are not talking to each other. And there's this like train and pray attitude, and we got to get people together. And rather than sort of getting people together around a theoretical conversation, we're getting people together around the data to really look at, okay, what do we need to do in this city? And we're actually now requiring, in terms of our funding, that all the right people be at the table. We want the educators, we want the politicians, we want the business community. And that unless you get all those people at the table, we're not going to provide the funding. And you know what? It's been a really great incentive. In fact, we now have a program that's an offshoot called New Skills for Youth, which is about getting career and technical education back into schools. And we have a competition. 40 states applied for grants. We've now given planning grants to 20 states, and we will provide several million dollars to about 10 states to implement the kind of skills education that we need in the school. So really, really driving people together. And then the third thing is funding the right programs. I mean, the problem is there's so much money spread out all over the place. And I think, frankly, I apologize to anyone from the federal government, but I don't think the federal government's doing a very good job in terms of directing the funding to the right programs in the right places. And our hope is that if we can sort of get the data and get the focus and get the right people around the table, we can all drive funding to a place. And I think that's where we're starting to see some success, including in places like Detroit, where we're very active, where you're seeing growth, looking at where small businesses can create jobs. I mean, there's just a huge opportunity here. And I think this is, you know, it's not a silver bullet to the question that went to the Director General. But at a time when there are 4 million unfilled jobs in the United States, 2 million in Europe, and these are not minimum wage jobs, we should be doing a whole lot more to get people trained and into these jobs and create the systems that will have pipelines for years to come.
Thank you, Peter. I'm trying to accelerate because we don't have much time. No, but that's very good. Very important what you mentioned. Rodney Simpson, you have been involved in skills development from a very specific perspective that is helping young people learn the technical skills and entrepreneurial capability to participate in Atlanta startup ecosystem. From your experience, what is working in Atlanta and what more needs to be done to help young people from disadvantaged background and location? How can you help them to engage into the high-tech economy?
We approach the pain point. You know, there's the pain point that we're hearing about in the media and beyond is, you know, the lack of diversity innovation, the lack of diversity in tech, whether that's the technical workforce, software engineers, early programmers, those who understand big data, machine learning, et cetera, or technical co-founders to invest in. So just like we look at any startup, we invest in or we start a startup, we first identify the problem, and then we started working on a minimal viable product. And that minimal viable product is called Code Start, hashtag Code Start. And CodeStart is actually a collaborative, to Peter's point, with the Atlanta Workforce Development Agency, the Iron Yard, and employer partners. So our thesis of CodeStart is that we can invest $50,000 in a disconnected youth, 18 to 24 years old. They don't have a college degree, but we can teach them Java or some other in-demand language so that they will have the employability of an early stage engineer. So we're teaching them the coding language, and not just the coding language, but also the computational thinking skills, the lifelong component to it. We're wrapping that with career readiness, financial literacy. We're providing these students with housing, so we're taking them out of their environments and putting them in safe spaces, and we're giving them a living stipend as well. So the bet is, with the $50,000 investment, partially funded by workforce foundations and employers who say they're looking for the talent, I can create an early-stage engineer that is generating an income at least $62,500 a year on average, which is a high-growth job. And for every high-growth job that's created, there are 4 to 5 indirect jobs that are created from that as well. So we're in our second cohort of the program. We've now, because of the work, had Atlanta designated as a tech hire city. And what that means is we basically have a round table of all the stakeholders. We've got the employers, the large corporates, but also the high growth startups at the table. We've got the training providers. We've got the students as well. And we've got the government. That's about to expand into a national partnership with the Iron Yard, the nation's largest coding school. We're about to embark on a $100 million expansion across 25 cities across the United States. And we've seen the outcomes of building that top of funnel. In the venture world, we look at the top of funnel. In workforce, we look at top of funnel. And if we're going to diversify, we've got to create the technical talent as early as possible. And we probably need to start before they get out of high school. Matter of fact, when they graduate high school, whether they go to college or not, they should be able to have a skill that they're they can get high, upwardly mobile employment. And we're starting to see some success with that on the ground in Atlanta.
Maybe you need to do a partnership with the King County Council.
Oh, I'm already linking up here.
Well, can I just say, I mean, what we have found, you got to get to these kids before they're, you know, like eighth, ninth grade.
Exactly.
Because the drop-off after that is pretty steep. And this is why the work I think we're doing in the schools is going to be really important.
I mean, to that point real quick, you know, I'm a product of Atlanta Public Schools, and Peter mentioned it. Now you've got 50% dropout rates. And then there's a Brookings report that says even when they graduate, the system, the workforce is failing them. I think 80% of disconnected youth still can't find work. So we're now ideating with Atlanta Public Schools to take a cluster of a high school, middle school, and elementary schools, and how do we brand this as a tech and entrepreneurship ecosystem so that from K through 12, they're embracing the content but also understanding how to acclimate and assimilate into the culture.
You're going to lose complete control of this in a second, but I would just want to... We saw from this Institute for Learning and Brain Sciences that particularly for girls, the decision that STEM pursuits are not for them happens very, very early. That acculturation happens in really before they start kindergarten. So we're trying to figure out how to get way ahead of that,
right?
Because the opportunity that we have is in those areas. And if they are turned off by it, they're not going to have a chance to succeed.
And part of the problem, listen, it's all our parents' fault.
Sorry.
Right? Because they all said, sorry. No, because our parents all said, no, listen, every kid has to go to four-year college. And the fact is, you know, a quarter of the jobs that are being created in cities right now do not require a four-year college degree.
Yes.
And so I think we have to change the culture early and get the influences, particularly in inner city, for kids to be exposed to opportunities that don't necessarily require a four-year college degree. And I think the younger we can begin to get these influences into these kids' lives, the more success we're going to have.
Okay, I just have to say one thing.
Yeah,
I think that's true. But I think what we're talking about, too...
You'll get comfortable. We're not leaving for a while.
But, you know, the systems that we built over the last several decades don't work today because of the changing globalization, technology, automation. And so while I agree that we need to train kids earlier and people don't all necessarily need a four-year degree, we also have to be really nimble and know that what we're training today may not be what they need tomorrow. So it's not a set in time. This is an iterative process, and I don't think our systems are set up for that kind of continuous training, and I think that needs to be built in as well.
Yes. Maybe, Cecilia, you can continue and tell us more about your initiative, Make It MSP.
Right.
Yes.
So our region for quite a while had too many people and not enough jobs, and now we have too many jobs and not enough people, which is a really good problem to have, but is a real problem nonetheless. And so if we can't fill the jobs, our companies that we have are going to move to where the talent is, and we're not going to be able to grow additional jobs if the talent isn't there. We've had companies say, love the Twin Cities, want to be there. I have 40 engineering jobs, total of 200 jobs, but if I can't fill those 40 engineering jobs, we're not coming. So a wake-up call for us, when our business investment folks are meeting with companies for the first time, they're bringing in my colleague, Peter Frosch, who actually is responsible for Make It MSP. But the genesis of it was acknowledging this talent issue that we had, and we convened a talent task force, which was chaired by two of our Fortune 500 CEOs, but also included the president of St. Thomas University, the head of social media for The Current, which is one of our radio stations from Minnesota Public Radio, and a broad group of folks. But then we also convened a makers group of 40 much younger people that were kind of in this new generation of workers that look a lot different than our board does, for example, in terms of race, where they came from, and the work that they do. And the research that we did showed similar things, that if we looked at professional workers, we were going to be about 100,000 workers short by 2020. Well, that's kind of tomorrow. And we also realized the data showed that for every professional job we created, the domino effect was 3.5 other jobs. So for a low-wage job that we would create, there really is no multiplier effect, and that's just the economics. So we knew that we needed to focus on professional talent, but we also had to make sure that it was aligned with the rest of the human capital pipeline, if you will. So making sure that we understood what was going on in K-12, higher ed, worker retraining. And as we did that, we realized that there was nobody working up here in terms of a talent retention and attraction program. So that's where we decided to focus. It isn't that the rest of that isn't important, but as an organization, we don't do workforce, we don't sell, we don't underwrite. We have a very specific mission, and we want to make sure that we're not overlapping what other folks are doing, but we're complementing what they're doing. So how do we do that? We convened, again, asset-based approach. We have a lot of Fortune 500s in our region. We have a lot of great companies with really skilled HR folks who had never gotten together to talk about this. And so we brought all these HR folks together and called it the HR Collaborative, and they discussed what their issues were in terms of recruiting and retaining talent. Some of the things they said is, we're really good at selling our company. We don't really know how to sell our region to a new grad coming from Atlanta who doesn't know anything about this region. We also know that it's, you know, there's Monster.com, there's all sorts of places that people can look for a job, but there's no one place that people can go in our region if they were interested, whether it's for the private sector or the public sector. So one of the things that came out of that was makeitmsp.org, which is an online platform that provides a recruiter's toolkit. So if you're trying to recruit a young grad, there's a 16-hour tour that's going to take you to all the breweries that we have, show you where all the bike paths are, et cetera. If you're trying to recruit kind of a mid-manager level, you know, this is where the schools are, this is the Great Park System, et cetera. But we also have an online job portal that scrubs about 90% of the jobs that are open in our region. So you can go on there and you can plug in and say, I'm looking for a project management or an IT engineer, whatever it might be. And every job that is open in our region pops up. So, again, it's kind of a one-stop shop. There's also a welcome letter from our region to folks. So, and it's signed by our board of directors, which, again, is a broad scope from across the 16 counties that say, you matter, and you're really important. Now, having said all that, that's all really great, but again, the process just continues to evolve. So one of our biggest challenges, for example, is attracting and retaining talent of color. So if General Mills, for example, is trying to recruit an African-American professional from another part of the country, and they walk in, they say, none of your C-suites look like me, your board doesn't look like me, there's not a lot of future here for me, I'm going to go where I can find that. So we are really working to be intentional, we haven't figured this out yet, about how we make sure that our region is inclusive and welcoming of everybody in a very genuine way. So the St. Paul Chamber, which is one of our key partners, got a grant from the Bush Foundation to really take a look at the affinity groups that we had in our region. Several affinity groups, none of them knew each other. So it's one last example. So one thing that we did was we decided, well, let's just have a party for all of our professionals of color and see what happened. Well, we had over 450 people show up. And anecdotally, we had 3 or 4 people say, I was going to move because I couldn't find a community here that wasn't white from Finland. And now it's here. So it's kind of funny because we want a lot of diversity, but folks want to connect with one another as well. And so it's an interesting process, an interesting conversation that I think will continue to evolve as the initiative moves forward.
Thank you very much, Cecile. I think we're running out of time, and I would like absolutely to leave the chance for the audience to raise some questions. We can take two questions. There is a lady blue there, over there.
Thank you. Helen Santiago Fink, I'm a climate urbanist. In terms of looking at post-Paris and inclusive and sustainable cities, it's important that economic growth is decoupled from environmental impact and resource utilization. What are your areas or your companies doing to move in that trajectory?
Yes, I think it's a generic question addressed to all.
So we're moving forward with a dramatic ramping up of our transit system and proposing a $54 billion increase to our light rail system, which will put it on a par with DC Metro, except with long-term maintenance built in from the start. And then redeploying a lot of that bus service to serve more people. We also just implemented low-income bus fare, the largest program of its kind in the country. Fundamentally, we have to provide people mobility within this three-county area if they're going to be able to access opportunity. And relying on the automobile and the way in which the region has developed since World War II is simply not feasible. So seeking to remake the region, knitting together all the residential and economic centers and educational with transit that is highly efficient and gives people better opportunity throughout the region.
Thank you. Maybe Peter, you want
to? Yeah, I mean, I'll be very quick. You know, I'll say two things. We have a big focus on sustainable growth in cities, and I think we have, in fact, some of the skills work we're doing in New York, Detroit, Los Angeles, other cities, is around green jobs, jobs to, you know, to rebuild some of the parks, dealing with the stormwater issues in a lot of these cities. These are actually creating jobs and opportunities, and I think that, you know, as Minneapolis has done a terrific job with this, is, you know, people want green spaces, and I think there is a very consistent and collaborative opportunity to parallel economic growth with sustainable growth, and I think it's got to be continue to be a big area of focus.
I'm going to pick up another question. There is a gentleman over there.
Hi, my name is Jacob Mason. I'm with the Institute for Transportation and Development Policy. I just wanted to piggyback on that question. We're talking about inclusive cities and growing cities. How do we make investments in transportation and accommodate growing populations without pushing the more vulnerable populations into peripheral areas where there is worse transportation and it's more difficult to access jobs, which the jobs that serve lower-income populations tend to be more dispersed throughout the region and harder to serve with public transportation?
I will try to be very quick. Our region is experiencing the suburbanization of poverty. Thank you, Brookings. Alan Berube's right here. And it's, you know, because we have this high income group that's doing very well, real estate prices go up, workers get pushed farther out. Three ways in which our transit investments are going to help with that. One, we connect the more affordable areas with the job centers. Two, we create the opportunity for housing to be built around that transit, which lowers the transportation cost for those folks. And three, it provides us the place where we can invest in housing that is permanently affordable, where the transportation will also be permanently affordable.
You know, can I just say one thing? It's really not a great or MSP, but when I was at the City of St. Paul, I was the Planning and Economic Development Director for Mayor Coleman, who I'm sure will sign on as well. But when we did the Green Line, which is our new light rail line that connects the two cities, downtown Minneapolis and downtown St. Paul, one of the challenges were the number of stops and where those stops were located. And in the poor part of St. Paul and Frogtown, there were very few stops. And I want to say, I think that's where kind of this long-term view comes in. So many years ago or decades ago when Interstate 94 was built, it kind of ripped through Rondo neighborhood, which was the African-American middle-class neighborhood, just wiped it out. So we learned from that. So philanthropy really started to fund advocacy organizations. So by the time we started talking about light rail, which is 30 years ago, and got to this point, we didn't have those three steps. No money, no political will to make that happen. Well, our advocacy organizations understood what their power was, and they actually accosted Peter Rogoff, apparently, in Washington, D.C., in a cafeteria line and demanded those three stops and why they were important to the economic growth of the region. And those stops came into being. I think ultimately this development along, TOD development along light rail and ensuring that there's housing for all and choices for all really only happens with intentional policy by elected officials. Because the market's going to do what the market does. You know, people want to make money. That's what our country is all about. But if we want to make sure there's a place for all, we really need to make sure that the pressure is on our elected officials to make sure that it is inclusive growth, that the zoning does provide for location of affordable housing, and that if there is a huge gap between the cost to do affordable housing along transit, and not that gap get filled, to make sure that those folks don't get pushed out. Because if you keep pushing poverty out, your costs are just going to go up because you're going to have to create more transit, more housing options, more services, and then the provision of those services, which I think you've talked about, Dow, gets more difficult when you have to provide those in a much wider geography. So I really do think we're all in this together, but we really need support and leadership by our elected officials at the local level.
Yeah, I'm going to be very quick because this can be we could spend 3 hours on this. I don't completely agree because I actually think the reality as population wants to be in urban areas, we're going to have to move the geographic boundaries, and we're going to have to really focus on how do you create neighborhoods that people want to live in terms of transportation and jobs and schools and green spaces. So I think we have to think more broadly about how you actually, this is a lot of the work we're doing in Detroit, how do you actually grow these neighborhoods? The core of cities are doing well. People want to live there, but people are going to be pushed out. Okay, that's just the reality of it, and I think we have to figure out, I absolutely think long-term, I don't think public officials can do it on their own. No. I think this is where you have to have a very collaborative approach among the business sector, the philanthropic sector, the nonprofit sector, and really focus on neighborhood development, and we could have a whole program just on that.
Thank you very much, Peter. We're going to close the panel. Just one information is about the Inclusive Growth in Cities campaign. The next step, we have this meeting in Paris in November. In New York, we delivered the New York proposal, and I mentioned to you, the four axes of actions. In Paris, we're going to produce the Paris Action Plan. So in the Paris Action Plan, actually, we're going to be more specific about the type of policies that we would like to promote, working with the offices of these 50 mayors. And the discussion today actually is going to inform us and give us ideas on how to develop this very, very specific policy action. So I would like to thank you very much. Now I would like to call Antoinette Samuel, who is the Deputy Executive Director of the National League of Cities of the United States, which is one of our partner institutions for this Inclusive Growth in Cities campaign.
Thank you. And it's my pleasure to be with you today and sort of close out this wonderful event. I want to first say it was an honor to hear from Secretary General Guerrero. And we also want to thank Amy Liu of the Brookings Institute for being a wonderful host and a wonderful partner. And as mentioned, my name is Antoinette Samuel, and I am the Deputy Executive Director of the National League of Cities. I'm here because the National League of Cities has partnered with the OECD for the Inclusive Growth in Cities campaign, and because inclusive growth is fundamental to a healthy and thriving community. First, a bit about the National League of Cities, if I may. We are an association of city leaders and are committed to what has been stated here today, and that we represent both large cities and small towns and everything in between, and that through our direct membership, we partner also with our state municipal leagues, and we actually represent the 19,000 cities and towns in the United States. And also, for us, inclusion means many things. Economic inclusion is critical, but historically, local government economic development policies and programs have not benefited all populations equally, and have in many cases particularly shortchanged people of color, immigrants, and low-income communities. We look at inclusive communities from a holistic perspective because everyone in the community needs to feel invested in their city's success. Income inequality and poverty are critical issues we need to work on. But there are many related issues that are also a part of this important discussion. Inclusiveness means affordability and non-discrimination in housing so that neighborhoods are diverse and representatives of a city's population. It means acceptance of new immigrants and respecting and celebrating their culture and religious traditions. And inclusiveness means fighting discrimination, like protecting the rights of the LGBT community and promoting religious tolerance. All these topics are connected to growth in communities, not only growth in the economy and in increasing wealth, but also in the improvement of a community's relationship between people and one another. I would like to briefly call attention to a couple initiatives within the National League of Cities that we are working on that support at least the spirit of inclusive growth in cities campaign. First, I want to talk to you about REAL. After the events of Ferguson and other cities across the country, it became clear to the National League of Cities that strong city leadership was needed to address racial and inequity disparities facing numerous communities. So in 2015, we created and launched REAL, which stands for Race, Equity, and Leadership. This initiative helps city leaders address the growing and persistent tension around race inequality in America. And I wanted to emphasize that we purposely use the word leadership because it is our belief that it is city leaders and their leadership that should be on the forefront addressing these issues. Since REAL launched in March of 2015, we worked to equip local leaders with the tools to apply a racial equity lens in their policies, programs, and procedures. In the coming year, NLC will continue to provide these trainings for local elected officials while launching an initiative that challenges cities to actually take action in addressing racial disparities. I also want to talk about a program that we've just started called the Equitable Economic Development Fellowship. We've partnered with Cerna Foundation, the Open Society Foundations, Policy Link, and the Urban Land Institute to build an Equitable Economic Development Fellowship within NLC. The goal of this initiative is to influence economic development policy and practice so that equity, transparency, sustainability, and community engagement become driving forces as cities engage in new projects. Later this month, the fellowship will convene economic development leaders from 6 U.S. cities for a year-long program of leadership development, technical assistance, peer learning, and team reflection. So in concluding, I want to again thank you for having the National League of Cities. We are appreciative of this partnership and taking part in this important discussion. And it is our belief that together we can make inclusiveness a real pillar of growth in our cities. So we're very pleased to be a partner in this effort. I want to give my thanks to the esteemed panel. And just to leave you with a thought that came across as you were discussing your perspectives, we look at city growth, but we don't look at growth in cities oftentimes as just a physical transaction, that we believe that the growth of cities also takes in something more, and that is the human factor. When we oftentimes think of a city in our communities, we just don't think of the physical buildings that help us identify with that community. It is what that city represents, that feeling we get about that city. It is the heart of that city. So I think what we're all talking about is as we focus on the growth in our communities, the changes in our community, it is not just a physical transaction, but we must also pay attention to how we develop the heart of that community and that city as well. So thank you very much.